Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. I'm Brenda Donoghue, and on this week's programme, we hear one farmer story about taking over her family farm. We go on a summer walk through fields in County Leash, and we hear from local tug-of-war teams hoping to become national champions. But first, the British general election is over. So what next? Phelim O'Neill, journalist with the Irish Farmers Journal, is interested in what this Labour government win might mean for Irish producers, particularly smaller scale artisan producers who've been very negatively impacted by Brexit. So Phelim is with us this morning. Good morning, Phelim.
Good morning, Brenda.
Well, is there a little cause for optimism? What do you think?
Oh, I think so. We've had a turbulent period in British politics with Brexit and in the post-Brexit government and how they decided to divorce from the European Union. Now, when it comes to agriculture policy, there isn't very little difference between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, who are now in power with the huge majority. But there's one, I suppose, small sliver of hope that I think I would see in terms of a future trade and relationship with Britain. Earlier this year, after several delays, I think it was five postponements, the UK introduced full border controls. Now, what that means is if you're exporting goods that come from either an animal or a plant origin or indeed a fish origin, then they have to be accompanied by a health certificate and they have to go through border control checkpoints when they're entering Britain. Those weren't there. Those were one of the things that were done away with by the single market and the European Union back in the 1990s. But they were reintroduced again. They were reintroduced, of course, by Ireland and goods coming from Britain on day one back in 2021. But the UK weren't quite ready. They put those controls in place this year. Now, if you're a large meat processor or you're a large dairy co-op and you're sending a 20-ton consignment to a depot, a distribution depot somewhere in Britain, look, it's an irritation, but you manage it. You get one certificate done, you go through one border checkpoint, and that's it. But if you're a small exporter, and say, for example, you have a small niche business and you're exporting cheese or smoked salmon or anything at all, a little bit of speciality food, you're sending maybe 4 or 5 kilo consignments to a customer in Britain, that needs the same type of control process as a 20-ton consignment. And you also then, you're not going to send that, a lorry with that small parcel. You would send that as part of a group load. And that's where the problem arose. Now, Liberal Party has said they're not rejoining the single market, all of the Brexit stuff that we have listened to so much of over the years. But what they are open to is doing an agreement with the European Union to cover this area. That was an offer that was on the table during the Brexit negotiations. And I suppose what I'm looking at this week is, if we could get that reopened, or if the Labour Party, the Labour government now would reopen that, then that would be good news for smaller Irish exporters. And it would also, of course, be good news for British importers who have been tortured with these border controls for importing flowers, etc., from the continent.
You know, I'm thinking, if I'm an artisan producer, say, as you said, cheese, let's take cheese, and you've got, you know, every little couple of kilos, you have to get this certification. I mean, so have people actually gone out of business because of this, do you know, Phelim?
Well, it certainly has happened the other way around. I'm not aware of the Irish situation yet, or whether workarounds have been found or not. But certainly I know in Britain, whenever the full border controls came in the other way around at the start of 2021, a large number of small, what you would call micro businesses or artisan or specialty food businesses that had customers all over Europe, they just ceased production because you could no longer find you have the first problem of getting the certification and the cost of that. You have the second problem then of distributing. Previously, those would have all been packed up on a pallet, and there might have been 20 different products on a pallet. And if there's 20 pallets, that's 400 odd products. You cannot practically have those going through a border checkpoint where every one of those is pulled out in a chilled environment. Simply doesn't work. And that business has had to stop in so many cases. So that is where I think there's a chink of light. If it's not going back to where we were and we would have all the customs procedures, etc., still to follow. But if the UK government, the EU, get this sorted, then I think that would enable that business to continue or resume indeed if it has been suspended.
Well,
but of course,
Phelim,
that's a long way off because...
Yeah, sorry, Phelim, just one second. While we're talking about that, we have Birgitta heading curtain from Burn Smokehouse in Listunvarna, and she produces organic smoked salmon. And Birgitta, you're here as an artisan producer to chat to us this morning. And you once stocked premium smoked salmon in Harrods and Selfridges and everything. So what impact did these rules and Brexit have on you and your business? And good morning to you, Birgitta.
Good morning. Well, for me and other artisan producers with, you know, potentially sometimes not huge volumes, the cost of all the customs charges, the whole having to do health search, veterinary inspections and so on has made it prohibitive. You know, a lot of people like myself have stopped doing wholesale business into the UK. We do private mail order. If we keep anything under €150, we can ship over, but it's still onerous. There's a lot of rigmarole around how to export into the UK, and it does make it impossible. You know, you just kind of walk away and say there's too much administration in this, particularly for small producers, you know, to go through all the different hoops and jump through hoops to get the product over. Plus, of course, we do have a premium product, and if you add on the costs, it's going to make it too costly for the buyer in the UK, and too much work, really. So I just walked away from that business, really, okay, to do wholesale business.
Birgitta, can I ask you, so you walked away from your business there and you were Harrods and Selfridges and all that. With this chink of light, as Phelim has described there, would you reconsider stocking again in the UK or exporting again to the UK if agreements can be reached on these SPAs?
Absolutely. I mean, it's an important market, and it's a huge market. And it's
I hope
a
so.
Market that wants premium products. So yeah. Absolutely. I think we have all our arts and producers have definitely a place in the UK, and also, you know, both for British people, and also there's a lot of Irish people living in London, all over the UK, and they want to see Irish artisan products over there, but they can't get hold of it.
And look, Phelim, one question, and we heard there Brigitte's comments and her hopes for her business, but this time round, with everything that has happened, it's a bit of a reverse, because the complications may be on the European side.
Yeah, that's the one thing that could be a difficulty. You know, during the negotiation process, this deal was there for the asking, basically. In fact, it was the European Union that put that on the table first, and that would have solved the problems there, like that we've just heard about, or prevented them, I should say, in terms of the veterinary side of it. Anyway, it doesn't deal with the customs part. Since the negotiation, which went on from 2016 to the end of 2020, you know, much has changed in Europe, and much changing in the UK. UK have done trade deals with Australia and New Zealand, which brings and has opened the door for huge swathes of imports of meat and dairy products from that part of the world. Now, how will the European Union react now to doing a deal with the UK that effectively creates a single health market? You know, I'm not saying it can't be done, but it will be a lot more difficult than it was previously. Plus, politically, we've seen huge changes at the European Union level as well. You know, with the problems in France at the moment with the government in Italy, will the willingness be there to perhaps work on us having a more seamless trading relationship with Britain than they had previously? You know, you would hope there'll be a bit of goodwill towards a new UK government. And certainly the outgoing Prime Minister, to his credit, would have rebuilt bridges with Europe in a way that his predecessors hadn't. So I would just put up there, as I can see potential for a solution that would allow products like Bridget's there to get back to the marketplace. But I can also see how there would be problems in that negotiation along the way as well. So I wouldn't be holding my breath and expecting it to be solved in the next couple of weeks, or indeed the next couple of months for that matter.
Well, at least you can hold your breath. There's something to maybe hold your breath about. Phelim O'Neill from the Farmers Journal, thank you very much. And Birgitta Heaton-Curtin from the Burn Smokehouse, thank you for joining us this morning on Countrywide. Now, 2026 is designated International Year of the Woman Farmer by the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. With 18 months to go, are we ready? Women grow up on farms, they live on farms, they work on farms. But what is stopping them being the farmer? Most Irish farms are family farms and the farm is handed down from one generation to the next. Traditionally, the eldest boy would take over the farm, but it doesn't always work out like that. As I discovered when I visited Ashley Fennell on the Carlow-Kildare border, who's converted the family sheep and suckler farm to a dairy operation in recent years.
Can I just say, Ashley, you walk very fast.
Sorry. The long steps, long legs, big steps, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, how tall are you?
5'11".
There you go.
Yeah. The first year I went dairying, I held on to 40 of my favourite sheep.
I see you've goats there.
The field beside the house, yeah, so we have pygmy goats as well. The joy I still get lambing those few ewes is just, it's sad. I remember, and I'm the very same, my granny years ago, and the first lambs that hit the ground, she'd be out to the shed to see them, and she'd pick the lamb up and she'd smell it, like, and I'm the same, just, you can't explain it, just, yeah, sheep farmers will know exactly what I'm talking about.
So what age did you start actually running this farm?
We were all, it was just four kids in the family, and my father was diagnosed with cancer in 2007. He was only 45 when he was diagnosed, and he was 46 when he passed away, yeah. So I was 19, I think. It can go two ways, because when someone passes away, you know, all of a sudden you have a farm. You have animals on the farm. The farm has to continue. Someone has to do the work. That, you know, you can't just throw it there and say, look, I'm not in form for it today. And that was initially a burden, particularly on my mother, you know, like this had to be dealt with because my dad was the farmer. It was very much, we couldn't escape it. I found it very therapeutic. And I know some of the others did, the siblings that didn't intend to stick around or weren't interested in farming. But yet if they came home, they were gone walking across the fields. There was so much memories attached to this place.
How did it happen that you were the one who has the farm and is farming?
I was definitely out farming growing up with my dad the most, right? I had the love for it. And anyone that would know us would have said that. And he used to say, like, go get yourself a nice job. Farming is not for women. That was my dad. And not in the really old-fashioned sense, but in the way of, like, he'd be looking out for you. There's easier ways, you know, that you can live. And he saw, so this is a dry farm. It burns up easy. He saw, he went through that year after year. And he started, look, there's easier ways. Go and do something else. But when you love it, you love it. But look, I had applied to the CAO to do biomedical science in DIT. When he was unwell and I was doing my leaving cert. And that's, you know, I deferred it for a year, picked Carlow IT after that to go and do it because it was local. And, my father had passed more suddenly than anyone had expected. And suddenly, you know, there was a farm to care for. And it just grew from there, bit by bit, you know.
I don't mean to pry too much, but when your dad was unwell,
yeah.
I knew that, you know, probably coming towards the end in a way, did he know that you were there for the farm? Or did he think it was going to go to one of the boys or whatever in the family?
I don't know. And people have said since, you know, since I've gone dairying and I'm here full time and, you know, the place is radically different in the 16 years since he passed. People say, your dad would be so proud. I don't know. Like, I'm sure he would. But, you know, as I said, he would have preferred if I went and got myself a job that was easier on me, I suppose. You know what I mean? I mightn't be as happy, but that was his concern. And so it was a concern for me. So I don't know. And I know, like, the youngest boy in the family, Scott, he got married recently, actually. He is farming on a smaller scale, part-time himself. But my dad definitely tried to persuade him that livestock were the way forward, whereas, unfortunately for Scott, kind of, he preferred four wheels than four legs, you know?
The mechanics,
and he's gifted in what he does, but, like, definitely, yeah, ideally, I think I could see my dad was, like, you know, trying to persuade him that, yeah, this is a great way of life, but, like, you like what you like, you know? My other two siblings had no interest, absolutely none, and they'd still to this day say there's no way that they do what I do every day. I think they've both probably been in the milking parlour maybe once since in the 6 years since we've gone dairying. Yeah, so Brendan, my mother, we're living just down the field here from the main farmyard, so come on down and we'll have a cup of tea and chat.
Perfect.
Hello! How are you, Irene?
Thank you, I'm good.
I was just saying, beautiful gardens and flowers.
Oh, you see, we had a wedding.
So it was all bells and whistles, was it?
The bells and the whistles.
Yeah,
yes.
You couldn't let the side down.
Oh, no. We treated him as if he was a bride. He was spoilt.
He'd be delighted to hear that.
I know.
Thanks for allowing me into your home, Eireann. 16 years ago, your husband, Alan, passed away. And you were left with four small children. Well,
13 to 20. At a time, yeah. He was only sick for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So that's the time span we had to get the place. And we were sheep and sucklers then.
Had you discussed before he passed away that you have four children? How was this all going to work?
We have a very difficult farm here. It's extremely dry, challenging to farm. And I always said the farm here actually caused Alan's disease in the first place, the worry. And we always said, if the children don't want to farm, let it go. But Alan and Ashley would have had a few conversations about taking over the farm. Well, I saw the full circle here, how hard it was to farm for a man. And at that stage, I said we were shook. And Ashley was getting up. And at one stage, I think she had 250 sheep. We got rid of the cows in the end and we kept the sheep. But like she was going full and it was hard. And like you said, when she actually did her degree, I had a conversation. Ashley, would you not go and get a paid job, 9 to 5? Didn't we have that conversation? And Ashley kept saying, no, I want to farm. That's all I kept getting was, I want to farm. And I actually did have a conversation. I said, Ashley, I've missed so many things over the years because of the farm. I'm not going to be missing anything else because it's a 24-hour job, 7 days a week. Mm. And that's the conversation I had. But she knows all that. She was carrying books when she was only 4 or 5 in the yard. She grew up and she has the same passion for the farm as her father did.
I hate the word can't, and we've had that row so many times. And if there's no one, I'd call it a row, she'd call it a discussion. We'd be in the yard, and a job needs to be done. And, you know, my mother will turn and she'd say, I can't do that. And I said, I just get, there's no such word as can't. It doesn't exist.
And Eireann, can I go back to, you come from a farming background yourself.
Yes.
Was there ever any thought that you would take over a farm, or that you would even think like that yourself?
Absolutely not. I had four older brothers and it was always the done thing that the older brother got the farm. That was the way it was back then. But no, I was never going to farm. It would never have been talked about. And I actually don't know anybody in my era, ladies, at that time that would have been farming.
No.
And the woman then wouldn't have farmed. If she got married, it would have been the husband would have taken over the farm and then, you know, she wouldn't have been farming herself. But that's the way it was back then. Me now looking at Ashley on the farm and what she has made of a very difficult farm. Proud doesn't even come close to it. She is brilliant. She has a brain that I would just admire from afar. But she has the love of the animals that her father has. And she is just magic. Very proud.
Oh, well, that was Ashley and her mother, Eireann, talking to me on the family farm on the Carlow Kildare border. That's very debatable which county it's actually in. But I'm joined in studio now by Dr. Monica Gorman, and on the line from Limerick by Ashley Meehan, agricultural solicitor, and Claire Hurling fan. Kind of a contradiction there completely. But Monica, you were listening to that report. You know, the way Ireland, everybody knows everybody else. You actually know Mum Eireann and you were smiling away.
Yeah, Eireann nursed my father when she was in Baldinglass Hospital.
Wow.
When he was in Baldinglass Hospital, yeah. So yeah. Her positivity, like, she still sounds like the same cheerful Eireann.
Yeah, and what a wonderful job, what an amazing job that carers do at that time. So you know her in a different capacity.
Completely different capacity. And I remember actually when her husband was sick and, you know, we all knew she was going through a very difficult time, but she just stayed positive. And I suppose she's passed that to Ashley, obviously, as well.
There you go. You never know what's going to happen on this programme. But I was thinking about Ashley and I was thinking about her mum, and I was thinking about being widowed with four children, kind of teenage years, so young. And Ashley, when should a farming family begin the conversation about succession? Is it ever actually too early?
Good morning, Brenda. I just to clarify, I'm from Clare, and then I'll be shouting for Clare later.
Yeah, no, I thought I meant that Clare. Sorry about that.
When it comes to a proud Clare woman here, and when it comes to succession planning, there's never too early a time in to my mind anyway. I suppose my own personal experiences, I come from a dairy farm, and when we were, you know, 14, 12, 14, 15, we were kind of sat down because we had a small farm, and my two older brothers were stone mad for farming. So it was a case of, you know, have we to grow this thing to try and create viable units for the next generation? And I suppose then from the other angle, I suppose I come across, as part of my job, I'm an agricultural solicitor, I come across families. And I suppose especially if things haven't been put into place, it's really important, you know, you structure your business to minimise stress on death. Like, a death can be such a stressful experience. So things like considering, you know, putting property into joint names, you know, forming a joint herd number and registering the farm set up as a partnership for tax. So that allows, you know, cash flow, because, you know, if bank accounts and herd numbers and all that were kind of shut down until probate was done, that can cause a lot of financial difficulty on farms. And then I suppose, you know, just touching on the point that you spoke with Ashley and Irene, it's really important to discuss, you know, your, like, with the spouse or a partner. I do a lot of work with Embrace Farm, and I'm dealing with, you know, widows or widowers where there has been a sudden death, and they're kind of pulling their hair out to a certain extent, kind of wondering what would, you know, my late husband or partner or wife have done, you know, and they don't have that person there as a trusted advisor to bounce ideas off. So questions sort of should have, you know, would the deceased have been happy for the farm to be leased until the kids were old enough to make up their mind? You know, should the farm be left to one child? Could we divide it up amongst all the kids? And indeed, you know, could the farm be sold if there isn't any kind of, you know, successor as such that wants to take it on and farm it? So all those things, you know, it only takes an hour or two. That's what I always say to people that come into the office when they do a will. And, you know, it's an hour and they go, God, I'm so glad and relieved. That wasn't too bad. You know, it's so important to do it. It's so easy. A lot of the time it's just because people don't know what to do. But if it's just, if you just make, you know, make a plan or a will based on the here and now, and you can always change it.
And Aisling, do your clients who come in to talk about succession plans, do you find the family still consider boys to be the most likely successors, or are we seeing any kind of a gender shift there?
I do see a gender shift in that it's like, it's looking at who's the most capable or who is an interest in the farm. You know, I like, predominantly, you know, I have couples now where they don't have anyone that wants to farm full time. But even at that, I suppose, Brent, I'd see a shift that there's kind of a two-track farming set up now. You know, you have kind of low intensity farming. You have people that are working full time, maybe stressful jobs. They're looking at taking over the farm, farming less intensively, you know, and engaging more in, you know, environmental schemes and farm that way, kind of farming part time. And then you have, we'll say, the, you know, maybe where the successor is farming full time, and they might be farming more intensively because they're relying on the farm for an income. So there's kind of this, I think there's two paths emerging. And I find a lot of time now, you know, I'm getting a lot of people that into me because they're concerned about tax and changes to the tax regime. There's an agri-tax report that was issued about 2 years ago, and they're talking about tightening up the capital taxes. So I suppose there's a concern there that if there was a tightening up, or if you don't have an active farmer, will the same reliefs be available into the future? So, you know, as much as you'll have people that have kids that want to farm, equally you have people that don't have kids that want to farm, but they still want to look at doing succession planning during their lifetime as opposed to leaving it under a will.
And Monica, can we talk a little bit about the whole culture as opposed to the law? Because you were speaking at the Irish Rural History and Policy Conference recently, and you talked about this culture. So what is it about the culture that prevents girls in a family from being seen as possible successors?
Well, I suppose it starts early on in terms of whether or not you're encouraged to be interested in the farm from an early age. And, you know, we all have our kind of stereotypes and our biases, and they change slowly. So, and then if you're a teenager, like when you're a teenager, you want to fit in. So if you're hanging out with, you know, a whole lot of girls and none of them are thinking about farming, it's harder to kind of go against the grain. I think that whole thing of when you're a teenager, you want to fit in, you want to do what other people are doing. And if you haven't maybe got the encouragement at home to think about farming, you're not likely to have developed the interest. Whereas, you know, I think, and it comes across from Ashley there, obviously she loved being out on the farm with her father, even if he wasn't actually necessarily saying this is something that you should consider. And then, you know, the idea that farming is a tough life, you know, often out of a sense of care, parents would prefer their kids to do something that was easier, whereas it's better to be doing something that you love. So I suppose the going against the grain a little bit is not easy, and you don't necessarily get the encouragement. And, you know, there's still a lot of attitudes out there that it's about the boss man, or the, you know, is the boss around, is the, that the boss is a male, and that, you know, that's...
You're a great girl.
You're a great girl.
Well done. How do you lift that? Well, it's funny because Ashley, we were talking about, you know, the equipment that she has, and she said that has allowed her do so much. Yeah. So you can't say anymore, well, you have to be strong or whatever. There's so many things to help. But Monica, for you, women successors are not entirely new because your own mother inherited a family farm. Is that correct?
She did. And, you know, at the time when her father died and she inherited the farm, but with the farm, she also inherited the care of her mother, her ailing grandmother, and a brother who was poorly as well. So it wasn't, you know, it came with a cost as well.
Yeah.
But she, you know, she later then met my father, who was working on rural electrification in the area, and they fell in love and they got married, and she made him her co-owner straight away, which is not something that always happens the other way around.
Yeah.
And I think what Aisling was talking there about, you know, the importance of having, you know, things in joint names, because one person can die. So, but I think, you know, my mother inherited, but my grandmother, my father's mother previously, you know, she was widowed young. She was widowed when she had one small child. But luckily her husband, this is back in the 1920s, had left a will. And she then went on and married my grandfather and brought him into that farm. So I think there's plenty of examples. It's just that they're not visible.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, you were discussing at that conference as well about the Succession Act of 1965 and how that changed. And just briefly, because it meant that surviving spouses had a right to inherit a portion of the deceased spouse's estate. And I'm just thinking, like, what it must have been like before that act.
Yeah. Well, the tradition, I think, was that, you know, that the wife, if the husband died, was left, you know, a room in the house and a seat in the car to mass. That was kind of the tradition, that she'd be kept, but not necessarily own or control anything. And, you know, at the time, I went back and looked at all the Dáil debates around the Succession Act, and there seemed to be general cross-party support for it because people were concerned about the plight of widows. Widows were very often left in very poor circumstances.
And there's a lot of work now, you know, jumping from that Succession Act to what's going on now on the issue of women and farming, including the Herself report being prepared under the Department of Agriculture. Now, Aisling, you're involved in work to clarify tax and legal issues that might make ownership by women much more straightforward. Can you tell me about that briefly?
Yeah, I can, of course. Thanks, Brenda. I was invited by the Department of Agriculture to be involved in a stakeholder group, and it's looking at legal and tax issues that are barriers to women owning farms and being farmers. I suppose at the way the tax system is set up at the moment, it kind of favours a farm being owned solely by, be it a son or a daughter. So we're kind of advocating for changes to the tax code to allow land to be transferred to maybe a son or a daughter and their spouse. And it just gives security to, you know, the non-owning spouse in the event that something were to happen to their partner. I suppose the benefit of the Succession Act is that, you know, it brought in a couple of things like the legal right share, and there's rules of intestacy, but that only applies in a death situation. Whereas if the farm had been transferred before the will, well, then sometimes a spouse can be left very vulnerable. They don't really have any defined legal rights. So basically the farm could be transferred out from underneath them, and they wouldn't have any say, nor might they even be aware of it. So we're just really, it's trying to advocate for a choice, you know, in that. So there's a lot of great work being done.
Well, look, thank you both very much for coming in to me this morning on Countrywide. Dr. Monica Gorman, Associate Professor at UCD. Aisling Mean, agricultural solicitor and a Clare Hurlham fan. Now, my husband's Kilkenny, so I'm kind of on the board. I'm on the, you know, I'm on the line here. But have a great day with your children heading up to the match. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in and discussing that topic. I know we'll definitely come back to it again on Countrywide. Now, after the break, we'll be meeting some tug-of-war team members on the eve of their national championship.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Now, last week I visited Charleville Agricultural Show. Had a really great morning there. Again, a big thank you to everyone who talked to us on the day. But I was very delighted to hear that Mary Herring won first prize for her gooseberry jam. What a legend. What a legend. And as the summer agricultural shows roll on, today it's the turn of Adamstown and County Wexford and Kilrush and County Clare. And tomorrow the Longford Show takes place in Anybegs in County Longford, of course. And teams are travelling from all over the country to take part in the Tug of War Championships. Now, this is not a spur of the moment thing, because you remember seeing the Tug of War at the agricultural shows, and it's not all about the crack. These are highly trained athletic teams on an elite level and very serious about their sport. And at one end of the rope, I have Conor O'Brien from the Mighty Oaks in Kilkenny. On the other end, I have Barry Kildrenew from Killyloch in County Monaghan. And I also have Noel Higgins, Secretary of Tug of War Ireland. Noel, can I come to you first?
Morning, Brenda.
Morning. Jump up and down there for me. You're sounding a bit quiet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm here. Yeah. It's a bit early in the morning. No, I didn't have the coffee yet, Brenda. Sorry about that.
Get it into you, as they say. Listen, the connection between the agricultural shows and Tug of War, they just seem to go hand in hand. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I suppose, Brenda, it goes back to the early days when Tug of War, there'd be competitions among parishes and stuff like that. And predominantly, it was mostly farm and background-based athletes who was involved. And just evolved from that. And then, obviously, it's just an attraction and people love it. And just as you know yourself, nearly every festival that goes on in the country, you nearly always see a Tug of War up pulled out. And everyone enjoys the bit of crack. There's a show of strength and unity between the both teams.
And it's not just about kind of pulling the rope, the psychology involved as well. You must love that, do you, Noel?
I do, yeah. From a Tug of War Ireland point of view, we look after all the Tug of War in Ireland from fun festivals up to the elite level, or the lads here that are on their Irish internationals. And they're preparing, they're in a serious preparation now for the World Championships in Germany in September, and also they're going to England and for the British and Irish Championships in August. But also, it's just the dedication they put in, and to the dieting, the fitness levels, and there's an awful lot of travel because it's a niche enough sport. And as you can know, you've lad there on the line from Kilkenny and Monaghan, so you can tell there's a lot of travel involved, and the dedication these men put in, and ladies and children put in, is unbelievable. So you have to take a step back and admire all that,
And speaking of some of the lads we have on the line, I have Conor O'Brien from the Mighty Oaks in Piltown in County Kilkenny, probably interested in the match this afternoon as well. Good morning, Conor. How are you?
Not too bad now. How are you?
Good. Tell me, Conor, how did you get involved in all of this, in the Tug of War?
I had a few friends down at the club, and they're kind of getting me to train for a while. I didn't really actually have that much interest at the start. But then one night I said, I'll go down for a look. And then I just kept going and just never looked back, really.
And what is it that kept you going? What was the attraction, the draw? Because you do have to challenge yourself a lot.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably the bit that kind of kept me. I like the way it's competitive, whether it's in training or if it's in a competition. We'd always be competitive with each other. And I kind of like the hard training. You feel good about yourself after it. So kind of overall, I just enjoy the sport.
And tell me, whereabouts on the rope are you pulling? Are you at the back, the front, the middle?
With the Mighty Oaks, I'd usually pull in the front three. I'd usually pull number two.
Number two. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And the Mighty Oaks, that's a great name. Can you tell us where you got your name?
Yeah. It was founded 7 years ago. It was founded in 2017. And there's a big oak tree in our training grounds. So, they just we just used that in our name, and you know, we like to think of ourselves as mighty, so we just went with that.
Now, on Sunday, you'll be heading up to Longford. Is there any one team that give you the heebie-jeebies? You kind of go, they're going to be our greatest rivals here.
Well, I'd say Kilmarnock have looked very good.
Hold it. I have Barry Kildernew from Kilderlock. He's the anchorman on the team. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Brenda. How you doing?
Right, will you say good morning to Connor? You're going to see him in Longford on Sunday in a different capacity.
Morning, Connor. We're heading down to Longford to tie up on Sunday.
Oh, yeah. How you going, Barry?
Listen, not so bad. Barry, tell me a little bit about the club in Monaghan. How does it come about? The catchment area, all of that.
So, Kilmarnock Club, it is a fairly long history going back into the 60s when it was founded. And a lot of international medals, a lot of silverware in that generation of the team. We now would almost be the second generation coming through. There's sons and cousins and nephews all on the team of those guys that were on top of their game years ago, and I suppose that's where we're striving to be now. We're pushing on to try and get some of that success that the older generation had.
Now, give me an idea just how much training is involved, Barry.
So at the minute we are training next week, competition on a Sunday, and then the guys are doing their own individual fitness training in between times.
And whereabouts on the rope are you?
So I'm the anchorman.
Oh yeah, I said that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're at the back, right, and you're holding the rope and you can feel it slipping away, the other team are gaining ground. What's that like? What do you have to do?
It's I suppose an immense pressure that comes through, and the struggle that your team gets together. And I suppose the big thing in tug of war is all about the teamwork. There's no individuals. Eight men have to be working as a unit, and it's getting that unit to do the same thing at the same time and with the same response and the same pressure as everybody else.
It's the ultimate team sport, really, when you think about it, isn't it?
It definitely is, and it's been proven time and time again. Every team's only as strong as their weakest link.
Well, look, I want to get one more person in, if you don't mind, Barry, just very quickly. For a lot of teams, it's a family affair. Alan Byrne from Ballinasdole, not Slow, Ballinasdole in County Wicklow, is on the tug of war team there. Alan, is there any member of your family who's actually not on the tug of war team?
I think we've won at the moment, and it's not related in some way, shape or form.
All right, so who's on the team then in terms of your family?
Well, I have a father pulling, then I have two brothers, and then I have two uncles as well, and cousins too, and even the same under 18s. We have a youth team going, and it's the same with that. The lot related, and then a lot of lads from school together and everything too, so it's really just all out of the one community, one side of the village more so.
Are you looking forward to going down to Longford on Sunday?
Yeah, sure. We'll see what happens. All we can do is go down and try our best anyway.
And a lot of work, a lot of dieting and everything.
Yeah. But sure, so that's what makes it so competitive too and enjoyable. Is the other part of it too. And it, looking back on it.
Well, look, you're all there on Sunday in Longford at the Agricultural Show. I want you to wish each other the very best of luck in true sportsmanship. And the best of luck to you in the championship. Say good luck. And thanks, Noel, Connor, Barry and Alan.
Thanks very much, Brenda. And lads, best of luck tomorrow to all three of you. I three neutral in this one, unfortunately.
Right, that's you, Noel. Go on, guys. Yeah. Wish each other good luck.
Best of luck, lads. But we have a 580 title we're defending and we intend to take it home again.
Yeah, sure. We'll see about that anyway.
All right. Well, look, thanks very much, lads, for talking to us. That made the best team win. Now, I know that farmers have been watching the weather, watching the grass growth and thinking about the winter. These are worries on every farm. And if it's not the weather and the grass growth, there's always something else. So why do farmers farm? Well, one answer might be on a fine summer morning in summertime. There is a simple joy in walking your fields, checking your livestock, calling your dog, as Anne-Marie Kelly discovered when she visited Marion Phelan on our organic farm in County Leash.
The schedule here is get up late, and go to bed early. Yeah, that's the truth, because we're calving all year round. I get June and July off, hence you're here. And I also get about 6 weeks around Christmas off. That's Bibi. Hello, Bibi. Bibi's going to help us now in a minute to get little heifers that calved in spring down, because they like to hang out with each other.
And who's Bibi?
Bibi is a breed of sheepdog.
And what does she do exactly?
She's not trained. It's just instinct with her. She sees the group of heifers, or heifer cows, I call them, and bring them on down. So my name is Marie Phelan, and my husband Fintan. So we're a farming partnership, and we're running the farm. It's called Leash Organic. So we're dairy, beef, and tillage organic. Bibi, Bibi, she can't hear me. See with the wind. Bibi, get him. Go on. Yep, good girl. Bring him on. But that's what they do. They go in, come up from here through the gate, into the robot, get milked, and out then for the next paddock. Okay. So we have an ABC system.
Right. Now look, Bibi's waiting for you now.
She is, yeah. She knows what she's doing. There's no point in rushing them because, you know, they're full of milk. How would you like running without a training bra? Like? When you're jogging, if you jog, I don't jog, I can tell you that much.
Running without a training bra.
Yeah, thanks,
Marie. Brilliant. It's a brilliant description.
So these are the girls now. They calved this year.
They're great and fit, aren't they?
They are fabulous. And they are ones now that I raised from the womb up. And I'm absolutely delighted with them. There's Maggie now, is it?
Which one's Maggie?
She's the one with the fringe. I get in between them now. She's a hard one to stop. There we go. Hey now. Hi, Maggie. No, that's
she's very happy with you now.
Oh,
she loves,
yeah.
She loves you loving her, doesn't
delighted.
She?
Delighted. They're family-like. There's no, you know, there's no other way to think of them. They are. That's the way I grew up. Like, there's no animal here in our robotic system that doesn't have a name. Like, when they were fitting in the robot and they were putting in the details of all the animals, we had to have all the list of numbers. And for each number, we were standing beside each animal and giving their given name, because they're all pedigree certified.
Give us some names then.
Oh, for God's sake. So you have Bull, you have Music, you have Melody, you have Shark, you have
do the
Bambi.
Rose of Tralee.
Yeah, you know, they're all, and you have Maxima, you have, there's, I have to go out there, the Sexy Cow. You'll know why in a while, because I'll give you an apple, you can give it to her, because every time I come out with my hand closed, she's, you know, literally at me. Where's the apple? I don't know any other way. Like, we're only 3 years this September in dairy. We're 14 years organic. We're 15 years in beef. So, you know, we were started off with beef to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
Started off with 10 cows in the corner of the yard. They calved down and we grew our suckler herd, beef suckler herd, 14, 15 years ago to about 200 and something odd within 5 years. But when we started off and he said to someone like my brother now at home, who took on the farm at home, that I was going organic, he looked at me and laughed. Like, he thought that I was going to be growing veg, or that, you know, he said, what are you going to be doing with 60 acres? You're organic, like.
Yeah,
so when I started talking to him and telling him what the plan was going to be, he was quick to shut up, like. Mm. So what we do is close to conventional for outputs, costs, everything else, except organically. And that's the thing that I started off in my head, because I didn't want to be laughed at. Organic is a business, and that's it. It has to be taken seriously, you know? And the human race within Ireland has taken it seriously, because they want it. There are micro dairies out there who can't produce enough milk.
Your husband didn't work full-time on the farm?
He did. Oh, on the farm, no. No, no. He's working 9 to 5, Monday to Friday.
In a conventional job?
Yeah.
So you then became the main farmer?
Yeah, I was 15, 16 years in finance with two small boys. And it got very difficult, because we were coming home, went out into the farm, and you'd be out there until, if things went well, 10 o'clock in the night. If things went bad, midnight. So it's 2013, I dropped the job and went into this full time because I was able to.
You never regret it, did you?
God, no. Not one bit. He does the numbers. He checks the robot system and the iPad, I call it, is inside. So he checks all of those and he let me know if something needs to be adjusted. Like here now you're talking about, it's the first week of July, I'm wearing a hat, right? You're wearing a warm coat.
So how are you surviving then? Because of the white clover, is it?
The white clover that is there 6-7 years, there has to be reseeding done anyway, but the cows will find it, you know.
And what's the difference between the pink and the white for them?
The red clover and the white clover. So the white clover is for grazing and it'll till along the ground and reproduce itself. So this one plant could make another 4 plants within a year.
The white one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The red clover is a plant on its own that grows deeper into the ground a little. So once they have energy to convert what they're eating, they'll produce milk. People forget about energy. You know, if you've no energy, you can't do anything with your system. You fill yourself as much as you want. But if you don't have the energy, like the red clover, the sugars and all of that to convert the protein, you get no milk.
But obviously you're very happy because you sound happy. Is that because you've combined all your knowledge and background and family life together?
Yeah, yeah. And I love sharing the experience with others that want to learn.
So that in a way is the legacy.
Yeah, like if someone's got 20 acres, take an acre, put in your multi-species sward and just try and survive without that acre for the next 2 months and see how you go. Try it out. Not use what he usually uses, which is his fertiliser that he's so proud to be spreading and all of this type of crack, like, you know? Hello. This is Bambi. More interested in getting rubs. That's fair enough.
So she's come over for a rub, especially.
She came over for a rub, yeah, and curiosity.
That's Anne-Marie Kelly there reporting. And if you want to find out more about Marion Phelan's farm, check out her Instagram at leash_organic. That's all we have time for this week. Enjoy your weekend and a very good morning.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.